they hold our hostages is just absolutely and totally ridiculous. That this country sits back and allows a country such as Iran to hold our hostages, to my way of thinking, is a horror. And I don't think they'd do it with other countries. I honestly don't think they'd do it with other countries.
Obviously, you're advocating that we should have gone in there with troops, et cetera, and brought our boys out.
I absolutely feel that, yes. I don't think there's any question, and there's no question in my mind. I think right now we'd be an oil-rich nation, and I believe that we should have done it, and I'm very disappointed that we didn't do it, and I don't think anybody would have held us in abeyance.
Donald Trump, in a 1980 interview, back when he was a 34-year-old rising star in the world of Manhattan real estate, it's one of his first public comments on foreign policy and an insight into how the president thinks about Iran and how he's thought about it ever since the hostage crisis 40 years ago. The U.S. and Iran have been enemies ever since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. But our relationship with Iran is a lot more complicated, and it goes back far longer than that fateful day the Ayatollah Khomeini took over, or when Iranian students stormed the American embassy in Tehran. Joining me now for a look back at U.S.-Iranian relations is Kelly Shannon, history professor at Florida Atlantic University and author of a forthcoming book on that history. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Madeline.
Well, just in the last few days, we almost went to war with Iran. So how did we get to that point?
So the short-term version of that is that, the United States withdrew from the nuclear treaty with Iran, the nuclear deal, in 2017 to 2018. And that, combined with U.S. sanctions on Iran and the Muslim ban that keeps Iranians out of the U.S. Under the Trump administration, has helped to escalate the tensions. Before that, it looked like there might be an opening to more negotiations and maybe a lessening of tensions because of the nuclear deal. So I would say that the road to the current crisis started about two and a half years ago.
Right. And so there was, as you say, a brief window when the nuclear deal was in effect and signed for there to be a different relationship between the United States and Iran. That relationship has been unusually contentious for an unusually long period of time, right? I mean, 1979, I guess, was the low point.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, it has.
With the hostage crisis and all that.
Yes. Go ahead.
So, but before that, let's go back to the beginning. The United States, like in the middle part of the 19th century, had a pretty good relationship with Iran, right?
Yes. So the first contacts between the two countries happened in the 1850s, and they signed a treaty of friendship. But the relationship wasn't particularly involved or close until about World War II. Before that, in the late 19th and early 20th century, there were times when the Iranian government asked the United States to become more involved in Iran. And this was because they were facing pressure from Russia and Britain, which were both interfering in Iran's affairs. And they saw the U.S. as a potential ally. The U.S. wasn't trying to colonize the Middle East. It had this history of throwing off British imperialism with the revolution. Americans seemed like potential friends who could offer a buffer zone. But from the U.S. perspective, they really didn't want to get involved in the internal affairs of countries outside of the Western Hemisphere until World War I. And it was after that that the U.S. got more involved in Iran, but the two countries were developing a very positive relationship until 1953, when the U.S. and Great Britain overthrew Iran's prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, because he nationalized the country's oil reserves and oil industry. And from that point forward, that's when things started to become more problematic. After the coup, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, the Shah of Iran, was able to transform himself into more of a dictator. The U.S. very closely backed his government, and so a lot of Iranians felt like the U.S. had been involved in crushing democracy in Iran in 1953. The U.S. backed this government under the Shah that repressed its own people politically, and then a lot of that anti-American sentiment came out during the 1979 revolution. And as you've pointed out, the relationship has been a hostile one ever since then.
Yeah. And there has been, hostile in both directions. However,
yes,
there was also the Iran-Contra affair in the late 80s.
Yeah.
That seemed, so there were secret arms sales to Iran, right, under the Reagan administration to fund the war. in Nicaragua. So what was the sort of behind the scenes negotiations between the two countries? Was it as fractious as it was in public?
In general, I would say yes. So the U.S. And Iran broke off diplomatic contact because of the hostage crisis. So the U.S. and the Iranians never directly engaged one another again until we began negotiations for the nuclear deal during the Obama era. So the Iran-Contra deal was done through intermediaries. And I think it was very much just done in the interest of supporting the policies that Reagan wanted to do in Nicaragua. It was kind of a means to an end. But at the same time, during that time, Iran was at war with Iraq for 8 years, and the U.S. also provided significant support for Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And there was also an incident in the 80s where a U.S. naval ship, the Vincennes, shot down an Iranian passenger plane. So there were, you know, a lot of the hostilities on the surface were real. And the hostage, you know, arms for hostages type of sale that happened under Reagan was just kind of a one-off.
Right. And so I guess getting up back to the present day U.S.-Iranian relations, how do you account for the fact that Iran seems to be unique in terms of a country, maybe, you know, with the exception of North Korea, that is most vilified by the United States, even though there are other countries that we have deemed bad actors? Why does Iran take a special case for the United States?
That's a good question. I suspect it has to do with a couple of factors. One, the hostage crisis is a big factor still in American thinking. A lot of people remember that, and Americans felt particularly victimized by that and did not understand that longer history that led to the anti-American sentiment that caused the hostage crisis. And two, Iran has, you know, successfully resisted and kicked the United States out of its country. And when that has happened, the U.S. also has tended to hold, you know, for lack of a better word, a grudge against that country. And I guess the other example would be Cuba. And then finally, Iran is an Islamic country. And given the level of anti-Islamic sentiment here in the United States, I think it's easier to vilify Iran, which is Islamic, which does call the U.S. the Great Satan. And that resonates with the American public in a way that maybe North Korea might not.
What would it take, do you think, to repair U.S.-Iranian relations?
Well, that's a complicated question. I think there'd have to be a change in leadership on one or both sides. From the Iranian perspective, they entered into the Iran nuclear deal and they abided by it, and the U.S. still withdrew and slapped sanctions on them. So I think that there would be a very difficult time going forward for the Trump administration to establish any sort of trust with that government to initiate further negotiations. A different president who has more expertise on Iran and who treats them as, you know, in a way that signals acknowledgement of their regional position, and that seems like it is willing to give them some concessions to make them come to the negotiating table, might do better. But I think the fact that they've learned that, you know, a different president could come in and undo any negotiations that have been done might make it harder for them to negotiate with us. The other option is that the Iranian reform and, you know, dissident movements in Iran are successful in causing a leadership change there. I think should there be a more open democratic government on the Iranian side, then that could also go a long way towards lessening tensions. But I don't see that happening anytime in the near future, given how brutal their crackdown was on the protests that happened in November.
Well, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. That's Kelly Shannon. She's a historian at Florida Atlantic University. U.S. officials say they are confident an Iranian missile accidentally brought down a Ukrainian plane earlier this week. Here's President Trump today.
I have my suspicions. It was very, I don't want to say that because other people have those suspicions also. It's a tragic thing when I see that. It's a tragic thing. But somebody could have made a mistake on the other side, could have made a mistake. It was flying. It was flying in, not our system. No, it has nothing to do with us. It was flying in a pretty rough neighborhood, and somebody could have made a mistake.
Iran has said that is just not true, even though the New York Times has posted a video that appears to show a missile hitting the jet. The plane crashed just hours after the Iranian missile attack on U.S. military bases in Iraq earlier this week, and all 176 people on board were killed. Here to tell us more is New York Times reporter Natalie Kitroev. Hi.
Thanks.
Well, what is the latest evidence that American officials and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau cite for this plane being accidentally shot down by the Iranians?
So U.S. officials are saying that at least one, and we have an official saying that it's two missiles accidentally brought down this Ukrainian jetliner. You know, this was a plane that was in the air. It was climbing for 2 minutes before flight data transmission was cut off, reached 7,900 feet. It appeared to turn back towards the airport in Tehran and before crashing in a huge explosion minutes after takeoff. So this plane was in flames before it hit the ground, but it did not send a distress signal. So, you know, we're awaiting more information. But, you know, again, as you said, the Iranians are pushing back on that. But that is what the U.S. intelligence authorities believe.
And do they have physical evidence? Do they have, you know, evidence from these missiles?
Well, you know, a security camera captured the impact. You know, the U.S. officials are basing their assessment on is American satellites that are designed to track missile launches, which detected the firing of an Iranian short-range interceptor. So these are, you know, satellites that the U.S. is monitoring. In any case, they also have communications that they intercepted that, again, you know, support the conclusion that this was an accidental you know, the SA-15 system accidentally brought down this plane. So there is evidence. Again, we have not reviewed these pieces of evidence, but we know that this is what intelligence officials are basing their assessment on.
And are they saying that it might have had something to do with the attacks on the bases in Iraq? Because it was just hours after.
Right. Well, so this, you know, what we know is that there were these attacks that were ongoing. We don't, you know now what. First of all, we're basing all this on the assessment of U.S. officials. So
right.
The sense is that, yes, that is a possibility. The idea here was that the counterattacks were not, it didn't involve a loss of life. But that appears to not be true now, because if this plane, as intelligence officials say, was brought down by accident as a part of the activity that you saw that night, then, yeah, you're looking at, you know, close to 200 innocent lives lost as a part of that activity.
Right. Although none were American, 82 were Iranian.
That's right. And yeah, that's right. And that's why Iran has come out and said, you know, why would this have happened? These were Iranian lives, which is, you know, is true. But again, the point is that this was not intentional. This mm-hmm. was a mistake, according to, you know, the assessment of our intelligence officials.
And Iran's saying, no, this is not true. But they're not offering up any other explanation?
No. I mean, look, it bears keeping in mind that we are very, very early stages at this point. And so, you know, I think there is a lot of information that has yet to come out. You know, we don't know what the Iranians are basing their assessment on, but I think that what we know for sure is that they are resisting this narrative from the gate. And what you're seeing on the U.S. side, by the way, is that there has not been an official declaration of the U.S. position on this. And our understanding is that part of the reason there is that the U.S. government does not want to inflame tensions at a moment where both sides were kind of retreating from conflict. So, you know, the U.S. officials aren't coming out and saying, you know, here's what we know. So we are all waiting to see how those different camps develop their positions on this.
Mm. And will investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board be allowed to look into this?
It's unclear, because U.S. sanctions really prevent Boeing, for example, which manufactured the plane, from even communicating with the Iranians without an export license. So there's a lot of U.S. law that needs to be figured out here. And our understanding is that the NTSB is in touch with the State Department and is trying to figure out how to proceed. This is an extremely unusual situation, as I think is obvious to everyone, in part because, you know, when normally when an accident happens, the International Aviation Authority, you know, everybody is kind of convened, and you have the manufacturer and the country of origin going in, all is one. But those rules are kind of thrown up in the air at this point.
Natalie Kitroff, business reporter for The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the battle over a house in Oakland, illustrating the battle over gentrification, rising housing prices, homelessness. I'll speak with a mom who's living in the house and a representative for the company that owns it next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. What would you do for a roof over your head if you became homeless? Dominique Walker of Oakland faced that reality recently. Her solution was to squat in someone else's house, along with her two kids and her friend, Samira. They moved into a vacant home in West Oakland. The house is owned by an investment company in Redondo Beach, and that company, Wedgewood, bought the house in a foreclosure auction. Dominique's story has gained a lot of attention recently as a symbol, perhaps, of California's housing crisis. Dominique Walker is on the phone with me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us on the line is Carol Fife, director of Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, and her group is supporting Dominique with legal and technical support. Hello. Welcome to you, Carol.
Thank you for having me, too.
Well, Dominique, let's begin with your story. You moved back to Oakland, where you grew up, from Mississippi. And what did you face when you went about looking for a place to live?
I saw encampments where I've never seen them before. No sense of community. The block I grew up on, the community there is pretty much non-existent. Everybody has been displaced to cities far out, such as Antioch, Stockton, Vallejo, Sacramento. Nothing was the same when I came home. And then looking for housing, it was very difficult because of gentrification and corporations speculating in our communities. It's impossible to be able to afford, even with multiple jobs, to afford the rent here.
Mm. So you have a couple of jobs?
Yes.
And what are those jobs?
I'm a full-time organizer, and also I deliver for a food service.
Uh-huh. So your salary in those two jobs, you can't afford to pay the prevailing rent in Oakland? What kind of rents were you looking at?
$2,500 to, like, it goes up to $4,000 some places.
Wow. And then, so what did you think when you saw this empty house? Did you think, okay, I'll just move into it? Or how did you come to that decision to move into this house?
The house on Magnolia Street was an eyesore on the block, doing work in the community. Folks pointed to this house in particular, saying it's been vacant, and just letting us know all the vacancies in their neighborhood when we're talking about people being homeless. And this house in particular was an eyesore. It's on the block of Magnolia, which is a beautiful block in West Oakland. And it was the only house that wasn't upkept. We had to pressure wash the outside. And when you say squatters, I don't consider myself a squatter at all. We moved in. We had to dust, deep clean, pressure washed the outside, and we've made it a home here.
Mm. So you don't say you're a squatter, but you don't own the place or pay rent, right?
We pay bills here. We pay the internet, we pay PG&E, EB Mud, we pay bills here.
Right. But the owner says, well, you're actually...
We tried to pay rent. They wouldn't accept it.
Oh, they wouldn't.
No.
What kind of rent could you afford if you wanted to stay in that house? What would you be willing to pay?
I don't want to rent this house. I want to own the house.
Okay. And how much would you offer to buy it?
What they paid for it.
Which is about, what, $500,000?
Yes.
Okay. So, Carol, turning to you, can you talk about the bigger picture here?
So the larger picture here is that speculation is driving up the cost of rents for working class people, not only in Oakland, but around the country and around the world. And because we believe that housing is a human right, we believe that everyone should have access to affordable, safe, and secure housing, not just the people who can pay the highest price tag.
And so you're part of a bigger movement. Where do you see this going beyond Dominique in this particular house? Are there more women, more moms, more people who are now going to look at doing the same thing?
There are thousands of people that are rising up in the city of Oakland, the home of the Panther Party, of revolutionary movements that are saying the way that we deal with housing in this city is ending. And so I can't speak to what individuals and folks will do, but I do know that a new housing movement is being birthed right here. We have dozens of people who are on rent strikes and who are fighting corporate landlords who are just steamrolling community. We have a building, a 14-unit building with Spanish-speaking folks who are being gouged by their landlord who is not providing the basic necessities of a building. And so they're on a rent strike. We have people that we know that are pushing back against a corporate landlord named Mosser that are saying the capital improvements that you're telling the city that you need to do in order to raise our rents are wrong, and we're not taking it anymore. So yes, we are a part of a larger movement that we hope takes fire all across the East Bay, where we have some of the housing, the highest housing costs in California, and hopefully that will take wings, and the entire state will see.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
That's Carol Fife and Dominique Walker. Dominique Walker is living in a house in Oakland owned by a real estate company based here in Southern California. Well, joining us now is Sam Singer. He represents Wedgewood. That's the company that owns the property. Hi, Sam.
Good afternoon.
All right. So let's take on some of what we just heard. And I want to just turn it to you. Why not sell the property to Dominique Walker for basically what you bought it for?
Let's take a look at the situation, what really occurred. These squatters broke into Wedgewood Properties' home in Oakland, and they're illegally occupying it. They have no legal or ethical defense for their actions. Why would anyone who owned a property sell it to someone who's attempting to steal it from them?
Well, I think they would take exception with the word steal.
No. They can take exception with it, but they're thieves. You know, when you break into someone's home and you illegally occupy it, you're a thief, and there's no getting around that.
Well, they have said that they are willing to pay rent, that they're paying their bills, that they have spruced up the place, steam cleaned it. They said it was in disrepair. So what do you make of those overtures?
I think they're hollow overtures meant to cover over a crime. Let me put it this way. If there's anybody who's listening in to KCRW who leaves their apartment or their home for the day, and when they come back, there's a group of people inside of it who've changed all their things around, who've changed their belongings around, and said to the actual owner, the listener in this case, hey, you know, I'd like to take over, pay some rent, or pay what you're paying, and I'd like to use all the things that are in your house. I don't think there are very many people who'd accept that as an honest proposition. They would call the police, or in this case, in Wedgwood's case, they'd go to the courts, which are the appropriate way to get rid of squatters.
Well, I think they would say that you're acting irresponsibly as corporate speculators, unethically driving up prices in the neighborhood so that the original residents can't live there anymore.
The original residents live there right now, and I would say that the people who were neighbors of 2928 Magnolia Street in Oakland, I'd say chances are their property values right now, with squatters in the home who were there illegally, that their property values are in significant danger. What Wedgwood does is the company goes in, it takes distressed homes that have been foreclosed upon, it rehabilitates them, it employs local people, local real estate agents, painters, contractors, and it fixes those homes up and it sells them, the vast majority of the time, to first-time home buyers. So they're a housing creator, whereas these individuals, these squatters, are housing destroyers.
And how much do you think you can sell the property for once it's fixed up and on the market?
It's impossible to say because we'll have to see how much damage has been done by these individuals once, hopefully, the court orders them out.
And when do you expect that to happen?
Everyone is waiting for the judge's decision in this case. The one other thing I would add to this is, Wedgwood has listened very carefully to what these squatters have said. And while it doesn't agree, obviously, with their methods, in fact, it condemns them. It understands that these are heartfelt sentiments. So one of the things that Wedgwood has done is it's teamed up with a Los Angeles-based nonprofit, Shelter 37, and it is going to share in the profits of the rehabilitation of this home, as well as provide job training to at-risk Oakland youth as part of the home's restoration. So as soon as these squatters are out, there's going to be a real benefit to the community because the home is going to be renovated. It's going to use local at-risk youth, and then the proceeds are going to be split with a nonprofit, Shelter 37, to help other at-risk youth.
Sam Singer is a spokesman for Wedgwood Properties. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the history of marginal communities here in Los Angeles can be told through graffiti.
In the most basic form, tagging and the signature and the autographs people leave behind, there's no putting boundaries on that. And because it's illegal, it's immeasurably more powerful.
What one woman found when she went into tunnels and under bridges, graffiti from 100 years ago, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's a crime to graffiti, and yet graffiti is fetishized in popular culture. Banksy's works, for example, are worth millions. But in its raw form, graffiti has mainly been an act of rebellion. Here in L.A., it's been around for more than a century, and it tells and traces the history of the city even as it is being erased. Susan Phillips has documented that history in her new book. It's called The City Beneath, A Century of Los Angeles Graffiti. She tracks the city's graffiti back to the early 20th century, the hobo, soldiers, and Japanese internees, up to the present. And she joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
So you spent 25 years researching this.
Yes.
And what did that entail?
Well, I started out looking at gang graffiti, and I really started in 1990 with that project, and just became completely obsessed with the linkage that I saw between art and social life and how incredibly vibrant it was, incredibly painful it was, and it was so complex. And so I wrote my first book on gang graffiti. It took me 10 years to do it. And never realized, I think, that there was older stuff around. And it literally took me about a decade to figure out how to see that other stuff. And so once I found the first older piece, which was from 1931, it was underneath a bridge. I realized, oh, I just hadn't been looking in the right places, and that there really was a whole world of graffiti that I had just never seen because I had only had eyes for spray paint, kind of.
Uh-huh.
And then I started looking at a smaller scale in pencil, charcoal, chalk, these little very tiny fragile markings that were signatures that people had left behind over the course of the 20th century. And I just sort of continued, starting about 20 years ago, collecting this stuff. And
by collecting, you mean going out and photographing
exploring the city, you know, going under bridges, going into storm drain tunnels, like having a great time, kind of having a different relationship, nurturing a different relationship to the city of Los Angeles, getting to know the infrastructure of the city in a way that I think most people kind of drive over or through.
And like the literal underground of the
city. Yes, the literal underground. It's literally a history from underneath the city. and so at that point, sometime in 2013, I realized, oh, the oldest graffiti I have, which is from 1914, is about to turn 100. I should really write a book. And I realize I have a century's worth of, I have graffiti from every decade. I'll do a simple photo book, you know.
Mm-hmm. A simple photo.
And I was like, it'll be done in 6 months. You
know?
but it wasn't. And it took me 5 years.
So when you were doing your gang graffiti and not seeing this other graffiti, were they actually side by side? Were they in the same areas?
Most of the time, no. Most of the gang graffiti is neighborhood based.
Uh-huh.
And so it gets erased and written again and erased and written again. When I first started doing that work in 1990, whitewashing was not a thing. But now everything is really whitewashed rather quickly. The stuff that I ended up finding does have other graffiti companions in terms of contemporary writers that are kind of doing the New York style writing and tagging and piecing. But and so a lot of the early stuff has now been covered by that genre. The writing that has remained up has been protected by weird flukes within the urban infrastructure. You know, the fact that the riverbed is at 90 degrees instead of a 45 degree angle, or, you know, there's just different things that have protected it in odd ways. Once graffiti writers got rollers going, paint and rollers, that it's all the it's game over for the older graffiti.
So it's not the authorities whitewashing necessarily, it's other graffiti writers.
I would say that it's mostly other graffiti writers, but it's definitely the authorities as well. It's both of those things
and
working
people
together.
Who are gentrifying, developers, and they're tearing down walls.
Oh yeah, anybody who tears down a bridge is destroying, a historic bridge in LA is destroying just untold numbers of voices from the past without even realizing it.
Well, let's talk about some of the stuff that you have discovered, some of the really older stuff. And you go into this place called JK's Tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's tons of scribbling by a guy named JK.
Yeah.
And you forensically figured out who JK was. Who is he?
Well,
who was he?
We don't actually know exactly who he was. And I have to say that a friend introduced me to that site. So the notion of discovery in any of this material is like literally half the time it's somebody else taking you by the hand and showing it to you. In terms of JK, that tunnel, and he actually is a carver, carves in a lot of different places in the city, sort of near the downtown area. He's definitely from Connecticut. He's probably schizophrenic. There's definitely mental illness going on with the compulsive listing that he's doing and this carving that he's doing of basically his whole version of a history of the world in this tunnel, in keywords and place names. It's absolutely fascinating. The point of JK's Tunnel is that the mysteries in graffiti are alive and well, and the most fun part of the process, I think.
So this was a guy who was likely homeless, maybe lived in this tunnel, spent some time in a psychiatric ward, because he documents that on the wall.
Exactly.
Documents the other places he's been.
Yeah. He's sort of probably something like a hobo at the time.
Hobos were the kind of vagrants.
Yeah.
They came, they would ride the rails and...
Yeah, this is like hobos are just this amazing post-Civil War phenomenon, and they're kind of the first, to me, I think of them as like the first subculture. They're like American folk culture meets subculture. You know, they're kind of the first counterculture in a way, because people just hated them. You know, they talked about the white peril coming to town. They loved L.A. because of the weather. So, you know, they would just come in hordes. That's how the newspapers described them. Set up camps all up and down the LA River. And they had a whole written system of communication. And so they created a system of communication that in part helped them to create community and belonging, but also helped them, like, hey, I'm going upriver on this day. And, you know, catch up with me then, Slim, you know.
So the graffiti was communication.
Yeah, it was communication. And that sets the stage for the rest of the century. Now, is all graffiti from the early 20th century hobo? It's absolutely not. There's just a variety of people who do it. But some of it is. And that becomes foundational for graffiti in the United States. It becomes foundational for gang graffiti in terms of some of the stylistic devices and just the fact of writing at all. I mean, hobos were the progenitors of all that stuff. So it's a fascinating history to look at.
And you found one, a hobo grease pencil marking from 1914.
Yes, there's a whole wall of hobo markings from 1914 to 1921, and they're all dated grease pencil, charcoal, chalk, rock, like I said, a railroad spike, one of the two.
And this is all around the LA River?
There's one site where it remains, and it's, you know, it's there. And it's not going anywhere, as far as I know.
You also discovered that these places were where gay men would meet and chronicle their time together or their love for one another in graffiti.
Yeah, that was one of the most powerful things for me, I think, about thinking about it. When they were doing work on the Spring Street Bridge, which is a really wonderful example of a bridge that was almost destroyed and then people fought to save it. And there's so much historic writing on it from multiple communities through time. One of the things that happened when they were doing that construction is that they opened up the abutments of the bridge. And the abutments are like these hollow places. And they remained open until sometime in the 1940s, and then they were sealed shut. But during that time, they had become a kind of place for people to go who, you know, on one side of the river, you have a lot of, you know, graffiti from migrant workers from Mexico, who are probably railroad workers. On the other side, on the east side of the river, you have this kind of queer space that emerges where there's this couple, Mike and Walt, who are there. They have beautiful, simple writings and sort of amatory declarations. And then you've got somebody like Lee from El Paso, who's, you know, writing about really kind of pornographic kinds of homoerotic intimacies in very explicit ways. It's really interesting. But the main project, I think, with all of it is to contextualize it within the era. Like, what did it mean to be a gay couple in 1928 and to leave your name on a wall at a time when homosexuality was basically outlawed? Any homosexual acts, you could serve time for sodomy. Mm-hmm. I mean, and the LAPD prided themselves on being one of the fiercest enemies of homosexuality in the nation. And so the walls became a kind of place where people could express those ideas. There was no public or private space of any kind that could offer that to them anywhere else.
When we think of graffiti, though, like I said in the intro, it is a crime, right?
Yes.
You're defacing property.
Mm-hmm.
People don't look upon it kindly unless they see it as part of an art form.
Yeah.
Unless it's been sanitized in a sense and condoned in art. Why is it so threatening to people?
I think it's threatening because it just doesn't obey the rules of society. And some people have said it's a signal of the fact that society has lost control. You can't actually control this medium. You know, there's no way to own it. It's totally free. There's nothing about it that can be controlled from the top down. You know, save what you're talking about in terms of, you know, now graffiti and gentrification can sometimes go together. And street art certainly has a relationship to changing neighborhoods and revitalization of different kinds. But in the most basic form, you know, tagging and the signature and the autographs people leave behind, there's no putting boundaries on that. And because it's illegal, it's immeasurably more powerful. Mm. If it were legal, it would be able to be controlled. So I've always thought that the illegality of it is one of the most, is probably the most important aspect of it.
Oh, interesting. So if it were made legal, do you think people would graffiti as much?
I do. I mean, I think it's interesting you ask. For much of human history, if not most of human history, graffiti was legal and people did it all over because from ancient Rome,
for example.
From ancient Rome all the way through, you know, England in the early modern period and the Renaissance and so forth, you're going through time as in a literate society where there's like no paper anywhere. So people are just etching things all over the place in each other's bedrooms. You know, they're writing all over the walls in public space. I think that graffiti actually signals a really healthy kind of civic and public discourse that's taking place. And it was prevalent all over, you know, in ways that we don't necessarily remember, because I think our memories have somewhat sanitized. Oh, the Elizabethan period. Everything was covered with writing. Hmm. Inside houses, outside houses, in the public square, whatever.
Well, as you say, it's been going on forever. But people now use Instagram to graffiti, if you will. You know, they're expressing themselves online. So do you think it will continue or change or, I don't know, recede a little bit?
I think that the internet has fundamentally shifted the need for the for bathroom wall graffiti as a genre, mm-hmm. because I think before the bathrooms and bathroom walls were places where they were like hookup places, and they were places where people did express non-normative types of desires and just desires in general, incredibly pornographic ones, which now the internet is like full of. So I think that bathroom wall graffiti has seen a serious decline in recent years. For the rest of it, what happens is they want to do graffiti in public places, in infrastructure, on walls, so that they can snap a picture of it and put it on Instagram. So graffiti lives on Instagram, but it also lives in the world. And so both of those things are going hand in hand. I don't think there's going to be any decline in it at all.
Susan Phillips, check out her fascinating book. It's called The City Beneath, A Century of Los Angeles Graffiti. Susan, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, should we roll out the welcome mat for Meghan Markle and Prince Harry? What does Megxit mean for LA? Next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, here's how Trevor Noah handled the news that Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, a.k.a. the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, are going to try to become independent from the royal family.
You see, this is what happens when you bring the first black woman into the royal family. Yeah, yeah. She looked at Harry and she's like, you need to get a job. You need a job. You a grown-ass man. You can't still be living in your mama's house, Harry.
Well, it seems like everyone has something to say about this. And here with his insights is Tim Tiemann, senior editor at The Daily Beast. Hey.
Hey, good afternoon.
Well, let's start with maybe the worst reaction so far. Madame Tussauds removing the Harry and Meghan wax statues from the royal family display. What does that say?
Yes, apparently so. Well, that says that Madame Tussauds doesn't waste time. Once you're out, you're out. And they've made it very clear that they are now out. And Madame Tussauds, being, you know, as news conscious as any news organization would be, has removed them. And I think, at least in the New York one, has put them in a room full of celebrities, which uh-huh. pretty much says where Madame Tussauds thinks Meghan and Harry's destiny now lies.
Well, is that where their destiny lies? Are they now going to come over here and become, I don't know, reality star show hosts or something?
Well, I don't think we'll be quite seeing them on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills just yet. But who knows, hey? Stranger things have happened. I'll add that coda to that remark. But I think they are clearly looking for a life outside conventional royal boundaries. And I think if you look at examples like Barack and Michelle Obama or other people who've held lionized positions in society and then become private citizens, they might want to follow a model like that. Or Oprah Winfrey or somebody like that who's, you know, a multi-platform icon and tycoon, able to work across many media platforms and still command a huge public presence. It depends really at the end of the day what the public appetite for Harry and Meghan is like once these talks that they are currently now in with the royal family over how this will take shape, how they are finalized, you know, what they end up with, as it were.
So it seems that the Queen was not really that pleased with this announcement yesterday. So.
That's right. Your listeners may have already seen that the Queen, deeply disappointed, according to sources, Prince Charles, Prince William, incandescent with rage. Those are the quotes.
Incandescent.
And then this afternoon, incandescent with rage. It's such a great word, incandescent,
yeah,
isn't
fantastic.
It? and then this afternoon, we're just hearing that there is, in fact, today a four-way telephone call that's been going on between the Queen, Prince Charles, Prince William, and Prince Harry about exactly what shape this exit from the royal family will take and what it will mean in practical terms.
This conscious uncoupling. Well, how will they afford to live if they decide, okay, no more royal money? Will they decide that?
Sure. Well, this is the question. I can't predict that. I don't think anyone can. There are lots of question marks. I mean, they've got a few decisions to make. And the royal family really has a few decisions to make because all that you've seen online on their website has not been decided. If you look at their new very glamorous website, that really is a pitch document. That is what they would like in ideal terms if the royal family goes along with everything that they want. I think currently the emotional tenor of the royal family would not be, how should we put this, receptive to all that Harry and Meghan want. And so the question that will be resolved over the coming days, and you may have seen this afternoon, the Queen now wants this resolved within days, not weeks.
Oh.
I think her patience has been fully tested, and that's why these quite insane-sounding phone calls are happening as we speak to each other this afternoon.
Why the rush?
Well, I think the royal family as an institution generally doesn't like being caught on the back foot. And I think the Queen and her courtiers and those around her, maybe Prince Charles and Prince William as well, have pretty much had enough flowing from Harry and Meghan all through last year and then up to the Prince Andrew Epstein scandal of later in the year. And I think they want to get ahead of this. And I think they feel incredibly bad and furious about how the news was released yesterday by Harry and Meghan. As you probably saw earlier on, London Evening Standard today revealed that Harry had sent a blueprint to Charles about his plans, but the Queen had said to Harry, look, you need to talk to your dad, really try and sort this out before going public. So Harry essentially defied the Queen's order not to go public. And those are the conditions under which this is taking place. Mm-hmm. So I think the Queen and the palace are now seeking to take control of a situation which they feel has not been within their control. And that is a very unfamiliar position for that particular institution to be in.
Well, Harry has always been a bit of a rake, hasn't he?
He has indeed. And that he has. And maybe when he was a younger man, the Queen and his family, and certainly the public, and still do have a lot of love for him and a lot of affection for him. And the same goes for Meghan. I mean, they're a glamorous, charismatic, intelligent, eloquent couple. But the manner in which they are doing things, I think, may be alienating some of their supporters. And it's certainly not doing them any favors in terms of negotiating tactics when it comes to the royal family and what they want to do in the future.
Well, give us a little bit of a backstory. And how have they or how haven't they been able to fit into royal life?
I think from the outset it was clear that they wanted to be a different kind of royal couple. Harry is not directly in line to the throne. He's sixth in line to the throne. So it's unlikely that he would take the throne. And I don't know if you watch The Crown or if you're aware
of
the stories of right. So Princess Margaret is a good example here. It's very odd not to be the one, right? You're slightly unfixed. You're kept out of the big rooms. You're kept out of the big discussions.
But you can
Harry
do
Meghan,
more things. You have more freedom, right?
He can, right. So the flip side of that is you have supposedly a bit more freedom. You still have to work within some parameters, but yes, you have a bit more freedom. And so Harry and Meghan have tried to figure out what that freedom activism could look like. They have a great international presence. They clearly have a lot of followers and people who support them. So they're looking to how best they can essentially sort of maximize that. And now they're looking to do that outside the confines of royal family. The big question is, do they still want the HRH title? Are they going to still be able to have it? Who's going to fund this? They say in their pitch document yesterday, their website, that they want to be financially independent. Well, if they want that, the royal family might just say, fine, go off and be financially independent, but you're getting no more from us or the British taxpayer, which is the other big factor in this. The British taxpayer, much as they would love or seem to like Harry and Meghan, would not like to fund a royal if they're not getting the kind of royal service on the back of that buck, if you see what I mean.
I do see exactly what you mean. All right, we'll have to end it there. Thank you so much for filling us in on the goings-on across the pond. Tim Tiemann.
Sure thing.
Tim Tiemann is senior editor at The Daily Beast. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.